The Syrian city of Aleppo has been captured by rebel insurgents, an offensive that came as a total surprise to everyone.
I think even the rebels themselves are surprised by their successes.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, what the fall of Aleppo means in Syria and beyond. Also, how opposition politicians in Russia are holding up against a seemingly impenetrable political wall.
This system was built by Putin step by step during more than 20 years.
Plus, many big Japanese companies require people to retire at age 60, leaving older people scrambling to find work.
It was very hard to find work at the public job centers because all the jobs has an age cap.
And salmon hats, a fashion trend among killer whales. That and more, all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us this Monday after a long holiday weekend. Carolyn Beeler is away. Today, all eyes are on Syria, where an anti-government coalition has taken the northern city of Aleppo. This after insurgents mounted a surprise offensive late last week against the forces of President Bashar al-Assad and his allies. It is the largest rebel offensive in Syria in years. The Assad regime has responded with aerial attacks on civilian neighborhoods. Meanwhile, Aleppo's capture by rebels has left many Syrians especially stunned. Syrian activist Razan Safour, who has family in Aleppo, spoke to Al Jazeera and said there's widespread uncertainty about what comes next.
I don't think I can even describe to you the feelings that myself and many of my family and many of my friends are feeling right now. We're very confused. We're very scared. We're very apprehensive, but we're also very excited and very hopeful.
Natasha Hall has been closely following the news from Syria. She's a senior fellow at the Center for International and Strategic Studies in Washington.
So the offensive was launched from northwest Syria. What we saw was regime forces and police just melt away in Aleppo City. And so the rebels actually entered with very little resistance. And this points to a couple of things. Primarily, the Assad regime has been propped up by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. And all of those allies have been significantly weakened in the past few months. Hezbollah's leadership has been decapitated by Israeli attacks. Israel has also hit deep into Iran. And Russia is busy with Ukraine and unrest in Georgia and other places.
So the anti-government rebels themselves, they appear to be carrying this out not entirely on their own, but through a coalition of apparently disparate forces. Who exactly is in this coalition and what do they want?
Right. Well, there's two main umbrella groups. There's HTS, which is the group that controls Idlib, and they are essentially the offshoot of Jabhat al-Nusra, which was an al-Qaeda offshoot. They've since tried to sort of moderate their appearance in Western media, and they've certainly gone around into Aleppo City and tried to reassure citizens, including minorities and Christians, that they will not be harmed. And they have really launched the offensive against the regime. The other umbrella group is the Syrian National Army, or the SNA, and this is primarily backed up by Turkey. And so they are essentially required to do Ankara's bidding. And that's why we've seen the SNA have a limited role in the initial offensive to take Aleppo. But we have seen a lot of fighting amongst that group and Kurdish-controlled areas in the north.
So let's talk about Turkey now. Turkey, a neighbor to Syria, had sought to negotiate with Assad over the past year, and those talks appear to have broken down prior to this offensive by these rebels. What exactly was Turkey seeking from Assad, and what's motivating it now?
Yeah, for a couple of years now, President Erdogan has sort of opened the door to negotiations with the Assad regime. And Russia has actually been also pressuring the Assad regime to reconcile with Turkey. But the Assad regime has remained intransigent. And it looks like Turkey must have essentially green-lighted some kind of offensive to pressure the Assad regime into negotiations. Now, that's speculation, but there's really little way for these rebel groups to actually launch an offensive without some kind of green light from Turkey.
Natasha, just getting back to the news itself, how much territory has now been captured by these rebels?
There has been hundreds of kilometers of territory captured from the regime in just a few days. So all of Aleppo City, we've seen the area Tel Rifat, north of Aleppo, that was controlled predominantly by Kurdish forces, also taken by the rebels. And then the rebels have also very significantly taken nearly 100 kilometers of the strategic M5 highway that links Aleppo and Damascus. Now, they've stopped short of Hama City, where it's likely that Syrian regime reinforcements are coming in, but they also probably want to solidify their gains elsewhere.
Do we know how people in Aleppo are feeling about this takeover of their city by these rebels?
So I can tell you a few of the people that I know that were in Western Aleppo City, which is an area that was never controlled by the rebels, were very concerned. These are, you know, not necessarily pro-regime communities, but there are certainly those that are concerned about a group like HTS controlling their area. But in recent days, we've also seen a lot of videos coming out of Christians emphasizing that no harm has come to them, that they have been able to make preparations for Christmas. I would say that they are still concerned about those rebel groups and what control over Aleppo City would mean for them and their daily lives. But right now, the immediate threat is shelling and airstrikes.
I mean, the region is obviously not short on crises nor violence right now. What does a renewed escalation in fighting in Syria mean for the country and for the larger region?
I mean, I think this shows that this is just a devastated region and that transactional deals that don't really address the drivers of conflict inevitably provoke more violence later down the line. Half of the Syrian population has been displaced in the past 13 years, and very few people have returned to Syria. And a big issue is, of course, the Assad regime's continued repressive tactics. So I think to change the behavior of the Assad regime goes beyond trying to distance the regime from Iran, which is probably unlikely, and actually sort of addressing the issues that Syrians have with the regime itself, whether it's the economy or that repressive regime behavior. But if the issues with the Assad regime are not addressed at this time, I think we will continue to see this cycle of violence in Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere.
That's Natasha Hall. She's a senior fellow at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. She joined us from Washington. Japan's population is declining, which means its workforce is shrinking. The Japanese government is trying to convince people who have reached retirement age to get back in the workforce. But it's not always up to the workers themselves. My co-host Carolyn Beeler went to Japan to report on the practice of companies that set a mandatory retirement age and how that affects workers and wages. Here's Carolyn.
A recruiter from a building services company in Tokyo is touting the benefits of cleaning jobs she's hiring for at a job fair for people over age 55. There's no age limit for the job, she says, and the work, sweeping, vacuuming, taking out the trash, it's not too hard. The companies recruiting here are all looking for cleaners or people to direct traffic. Many of the job seekers who come here are white-collar workers who've aged out of their lifelong careers. Most Japanese companies have a mandatory retirement age, usually 60. This applies to Masanori Masumoto. He's wearing a pinstriped button-down and holds a resume in a plastic folder as he talks to me and my interpreter.
I was working in defense ministry for 35 years.
He, like many others, retired at 60. He says he's here interviewing for janitorial jobs. He'd prefer to find an office job again, something more similar to his work at the defense ministry. But he says companies want young people for those jobs.
And this is driven by the fact that wages are driven by seniority.
Randall Jones is the former head of the Japan desk at the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Jones says in Japan's seniority-based pay system, workers start out not making much money, but wages rise relatively quickly.
And at some point, the wage gets higher than your productivity, so the mandatory retirement allows them to let people go.
After they hit retirement age, people often end up at smaller companies that employ lower-skilled workers, which typically don't pay based on seniority. Like Yokobiki Shutters in Tokyo, where more than a third of the 32 employees are over age 65. On the manufacturing floor, workers weld and use metal presses to make shutter components. Company president Shinjiro Ichikawa tells me he doesn't understand why other people say older workers aren't good. For him, if his employees help make profit, work well together, and he's happy with them, then age, sex, and nationality are nothing to be concerned about, he says. Upstairs in the office, 82-year-old Kanai Nobuharu is designing shutters using modeling software on his computer. He retired in his mid-70s, he tells me, through an interpreter. But a few years later, he needed money to pay for his wife's cancer treatment.
It was very hard to find work at the public job centers because all the jobs has an age cap, so I couldn't find a job.
He saw a TV story about this company and applied. He's a licensed architect and used to design nuclear power plants. Designing metal shutters is less technical work, and he took a significant pay cut.
Maybe I'm receiving half of what I received at the age of 60.
Does that seem fair to you?
He nods a yes.
Yes, I wouldn't demand that high amount because I'm already lucky that I've got a job. This age.
Japan is trying to expand its workforce, and Randall Jones, formerly of the OECD, says effectively employing seniors could help.
The work-age population has been falling for quite some time now, and so there is a tension where companies are short of workers.
Jones argued in a recent report for the OECD that the mandatory retirement age should be abolished.
What we have to do is break down the seniority-based wage system so that people are paid more on their productivity, their capacity, their performance, and not by some arbitrary requirement of how long they've been alive.
Jones says Japan's government does not seem to favor this move, and there's not much pressure from workers either, who see their job security as linked to a mandatory retirement age. The government has, however, recently passed measures meant to encourage companies to keep workers on the job until age 70. The presentations at the Tokyo Job Center are over now, and job seekers are interviewing with recruiters one-on-one. But typically, very few of these interviews yield a match. If you don't mind cleaning or directing traffic, then it's easy to get a job, says the Career Center's manager, Hiroi Takatoshi. But there's a gap between what kinds of jobs job seekers want and what kinds of job opportunities are available. Last fiscal year, Takatoshi tells me more than 1,800 job seekers over age 55 passed through here. 128 landed jobs. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
This week, we'll meet other Japanese who have continued working into their later years in a pizza parlor, driving a taxi, even renting themselves out to people who'd like an older companion. Listen for those stories all this week on The World. When you think about fashion in the 1980s, a few things might be top of mind. Shoulder pads, leg warmers, teased hair. Oh yeah, killer whales had their own fashion trend back then. Hats made of dead salmon. And they're bringing it back. According to reporting from the Vancouver Sun, orcas have been spotted off the coast of Washington balancing dead salmon on their heads. A phenomenon first observed in 1987. It is unclear why they do it. Scientists theorize they could be saving a snack for later. Maybe they're just having fun. Or maybe orcas are more fashionable than we thought. You're listening to The World.
Hey there, Carolyn Beeler here. When I was starting out in public radio, I wanted a standing desk. But public radio newsrooms are frugal, so instead of asking for an actual standing desk, I just grabbed one of those little plastic office recycling bins, like the blue ones, flipped it upside down on my desk, and plopped my laptop down on that. It was a standing desk for free. Now, I'm telling you the story because I am about to ask you for your financial support for the journalism that we do at The World. And that is my proof that we will use your donation carefully. So here's the ask. Please consider donating to The World for Giving Tuesday. As an independent, nonprofit newsroom, we rely on you to support our work. You help us send journalists all around the world to tell stories from the human level, to connect the global to the local. You make our work possible. Now, our money folks tell me that we've got a goal of raising $67,000 by the end of the year. And thanks to a generous match, your donation will go twice as far. So this is really the perfect time to give. And it's super easy. Just visit theworld.org/give to donate. That is theworld.org/give. Or visit the link in our episode notes. Oh, and if you give on Giving Tuesday, we will send you a limited edition button as a small token of our gratitude. Thanks so much for your support. Oh, and I should tell you, I do now have a proper standing desk set up in the studio.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. At The Hague today, the International Criminal Court opened its annual meeting with some stark words. Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan invoked the plight of Palestinians, Ukrainians, and Sudanese, people suffering, he says, as a result of crimes that the court is trying to pursue.
We see, seemingly, a world in which people feel their lives don't matter.
Meanwhile, the president of the ICC, Judge Tomoko Akane, said that attacks on the court could undermine its very existence. Akane made specific mention of using economic sanctions to threaten the ICC. That's a reference to U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham saying the U.S. would sanction its allies should they help the ICC. Graham was among the many U.S. politicians to voice outrage over the court's arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Judge Akane addressed the situation today.
We firmly reject any attempt to influence the independence and the impartiality of the court.
Akane also spoke last week against countries issuing arrest warrants for ICC judges, a jab at Russia, which has done exactly that. To be an opposition politician in Russia is not for the faint of heart. As the country grows more authoritarian, the pressure on those who don't support the Kremlin has followed. Earlier this month, one of Russia's most prominent opposition politicians, Boris Vishnevsky, a former deputy in St. Petersburg's regional legislature, announced his resignation from politics. Vishnevsky speaking here in a video posted on the messaging app Telegram. It had the vibe of a concession speech, with Vishnevsky vowing to keep on fighting. But as we hear from reporter Levi Bridges, winning elections isn't the problem.
Ludmila Vasilyeva of St. Petersburg isn't your typical Russian politician. For starters, Vasilyeva is 83 years old. She's got short white hair and frequently wears bright cherry red lipstick. And she's known for protesting. Standing beside a snowbank on a cold winter's night, a Russian journalist films as Vasilyeva denounces Russia's invasion of Ukraine. She says Putin has betrayed the country with this conflict. You don't hear a lot of Russians voicing their discontent so openly these days. Many have been jailed for speaking about the war. But Vasilyeva says she isn't afraid. Over WhatsApp, Vasilyeva tells me, "I'm in my later years now, you understand? I'm just a humble woman who lives off a small pension." Vasilyeva is a babushka, and she uses her respected position in society as a Russian grandmother, an elder, to say things others are afraid to. Earlier this year, Vasilyeva used her platform to enter politics, launching a campaign to become the governor of St. Petersburg. She says our campaign slogan was St. Petersburg, City of Peace. My hope was that people all over Russia would be inspired by our campaign and rise up to demand peace, she says. In Russia, opposition candidates can launch campaigns all they want, but under Putin, the government has put many onerous measures in place to stop them from actually getting on the ballot. To run, Vasilyeva had to gather 80,000 signatures in just under a month, a nearly impossible task for a small, scrappy campaign. Vasilyeva's son, Denis, who helped lead his mother's campaign, says he had no illusions about what they were up against.
From
the very beginning, he says, we knew that collecting so many signatures would be an impossible task. And in the end, they only got a few thousand. Mitchell Polman has worked as an election observer throughout the former Soviet Union, including Russia. He says that governments in the former Soviet Union have invalidated signatures gathered by opposition candidates to stop them from running or put pressure on people who signed.
You can also just pay visits to people and say, is this really your signature? And they may say, oh, no, that wasn't really me. I didn't sign that, just for fear of the consequences.
Polman says that Russian authorities sometimes put economic pressure on would-be opposition candidates to stop them from running. And if that doesn't work, authorities can lean on a recent law that allows the government to designate pretty much anyone as what's called a foreign agent, meaning they accept support from abroad, which bars them from holding political office.
Это человек, который занимается общественной деятельностью за деньги иностранного государства.
At an economic forum last year, Putin defended the foreign agent law, saying it only targets Russians who receive economic support from foreign countries. But critics say that in reality, the law is intentionally vague, so it can just be used frivolously to bar any opposition politician who promotes values the Kremlin doesn't support. In a video posted on Facebook a few years ago, an openly gay deputy in St. Petersburg named Sergei Troshin waves a rainbow flag at a meeting, demanding lawmakers take LGBTQ issues more seriously. The authorities pushed Troshin out of office this fall by simply labeling him a foreign agent, which Troshin denies. Over the phone, Troshin tells me the future for opposition politics is getting dim. He says as long as the current regime holds power, there's almost nothing the opposition can achieve. They're just in survival mode now. The Russian government didn't reply to requests I made to comment about the crackdown on Russia's opposition. Arina Busigina is a Russian political scientist at Harvard. She says political oppression is a long-term Kremlin strategy.
This system was built by Putin step by step during more than 20 years.
Many Russians are reluctant to advocate for change today. I talked to a young man in Siberia who was afraid to give his name. Voters held a silent demonstration in his town during elections this year, protesting what they saw as sham elections and holding signs against the war. He was too spooked to participate.
If people will scream "Free Russia" or "Stop Putin," policemen can just arrest people.
But not all Russians are just tuning out. I talked to another young Russian who helped gather thousands of signatures this year for an anti-war candidate. They didn't get on the ballot, but he's still motivated to fight for a more democratic Russia.
Russia, it's my country. It's just my homeland. That's why I like to be engaged in the political processes and other things in Russia.
The campaign of Ludmila Vasilyeva, the 83-year-old who tried to run for governor of St. Petersburg, sees their failure as a success.
Результат кампании показать всему миру, да, что...
One of the campaign's main organizers and son of the candidate, Denis Vasilyev, says they showed the entire world that many Russians don't support Putin or war in Ukraine. They succeeded in proving Russia could be a very different country, he says, if they only had free and fair elections. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges.
In Scotland, climate change is a threat to historic buildings.
When the erosion takes the archaeology from off the coast, which it will eventually, we will have lost its history.
Meet the people trying to preserve that history. That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A global agreement to limit plastic pollution. That was the goal after 2 years of work before delegates from more than 200 countries met in South Korea last week. Those discussions collapsed in the end with no consensus reached. We asked Cassie Barker to explain the breakdown. She's with the Canadian advocacy group Environmental Defense in Toronto.
Despite the fact that this is the fifth time that these negotiations have taken place to get us closer to a treaty, unfortunately, there is a handful of countries. These are countries that produce fossil fuels, who are invested in keeping us entrenched in this plastic pollution crisis, who have taken advantage of the consensus model of the United Nations and taken it to an extreme that once again, here we are at the end of a week of negotiations without a text to allow us in 2025 to move forward with a workable treaty. That shouldn't deny the fact that we do have a large group of countries that are ready to act and really want to start dealing with this plastic problem now.
I mean, it does sound like a group of about 100 so-called high ambition countries, as in nations that wanted to go big on cutting back on plastic. Those countries wanted a commitment to drawing down global plastic production. Oil-rich nations saw things differently. What did they argue and why?
Back in 2022, the world agreed that there is a massive plastic pollution problem, and we need this legally binding tool to solve it. It's unfortunate that these countries have decided to ignore that mandate, where we have a large group, the majority of countries, coming in and supporting progress. And unfortunately, it's countries that seem to want to hold up plastic production as some sort of model for the future when the world is ready to move on.
Well, indeed. I mean, the negotiators from Kuwait in the final hours of this meeting said the objective of this treaty is to end plastic pollution, not plastic itself. Plastic has brought immense benefit to societies worldwide. In contrast, let's hear the head of Panama's delegation, Juan Carlos Monterrey Gomez, on Sunday.
Colleagues, friends, everything we love is on the line. This is not a drill. This is a fight for survival. For those blocking progress, you are allowing this crisis to fester, and it will kill us.
No mincing words there, but isn't Gomez correct, Cassie? A lot is on the line with this treaty, right?
Plastic not only harms us, harms our health. It's a toxic chemical soup filled with things that disrupt hormones. You know, it's not a small thing that we're trying to tackle plastic for what it does to us, but it also really harms biodiversity, and it's made of fossil fuels, which is harming the climate. And Panama is definitely an example of the type of leadership that has shown up and continues to take the stage to demand a solution on this problem. And it's really trying to ask the people running this process to move past all of the obstruction and get us closer to the solution that we desperately need. Next year, we're supposed to begin the process of this treaty being in effect. So we do have another meeting upcoming that will hopefully move past this logjam and put a cap on plastic production instead of allowing it to double and triple in the coming decades.
How much can independent efforts to control plastic pollution solve the problem if governments are unable to agree on how to deal with it?
Many of us struggle to address plastics in our own lives. We try to do what we can, but what we've learned is that it's good for us to do everything we can as individuals, but we can't fix broken systems on our own. We need the governments who set the rules to set up better systems, to put in place stronger rules for companies that won't do the right thing on their own. None of us likes to be involved in a greenwashed or a fake scheme to make us feel like we're doing the right thing when it's not actually contributing to a solution. We really need governments to call these companies on their bluff and stop pretending like they're solving this.
if they can't start giving us products that are going to solve some of these many crises, microplastics is just one small slice of the problem, and it is everywhere, and it's in all of us. And so we really need governments to take this much more seriously. And we love a treaty, but that doesn't mean that countries can't do the right thing on their own.
Cassie Barker is the Senior Program Manager for Toxics at the Canadian advocacy group Environmental Defense. The Prime Minister of France is facing a political reckoning after pushing through a controversial budget. Prime Minister Michel Barnier bypassed Parliament to enact the budget, saying it was necessary for stability. But the sharp backlash means a no-confidence vote could topple Barnier's government as soon as Wednesday. Barnier became prime minister after June's snap elections failed to deliver a clear majority, and President Emmanuel Macron turned to him to address France's soaring deficit. Yet Barnier's proposed austerity budget has only deepened divisions. The political standoff has unsettled financial markets, with borrowing costs rising sharply amid fears of prolonged instability. If a no-confidence motion succeeds, Macron will remain president, but he'll need to appoint a new prime minister to steer legislation through the fractured assembly. Turning now to South Africa, at least two dozen children have died after eating contaminated snacks from convenience stores, or spaza shops as they're known. Parents and other community members are obviously worried about kids' safety, but the crisis is also fanning longstanding tensions around foreign nationals working illegally in South Africa, including an outsized belief that foreign management of those convenience stores is to blame. As Elna Schutz explains from Johannesburg, authorities are scrambling to control not just the foodborne illnesses, but also the social and economic fallout.
Spaza shop. That's the South African word for a small convenience store or kiosk where you can get everything from a loose cigarette to snack food to a loaf of bread. These shops boomed during the apartheid era when marginalized groups could not easily own formalized businesses. Now, spaza shops are at the center of a national crisis, making headlines.
Another tragedy has hit Soweto as we understand that a five-year-old boy, Siyabonga Mnisi, tragically lost his life yesterday.
I am currently in Diepkloof, where an eight-year-old child has reportedly passed away after consuming those snacks.
A 13-year-old boy has died after eating snacks in Kovi, Tolamela in Limpopo.
It's believed he ate crisps offered to him and three other boys by a shopkeeper.
In total, at least 24 children have died and many more fallen ill in the last few months after eating snacks like cookies and potato chips, likely from spaza shops and street vendors. South Africa's president says at least some of the deaths were caused by tubufos, an agricultural pesticide that is not allowed for domestic use. It has now been found on both the inside and outside of packets of snacks. This worrying trend culminated in President Cyril Ramaphosa addressing the nation in mid-November.
Our people have every right to be upset and to be angry in the face of such tragedies. At a time like this, we need to unite as a country and work together to end these deaths.
The president then introduced new measures, such as closing the shops implicated in the deaths. He demanded all spaza shops register within 3 weeks by mid-December, and a number of other interventions focused on inspections and pesticide procedures have been put into place.
The investigations that have taken place do not suggest any deliberate campaign to poison children in our country. There is also no evidence that the problem is confined to spaza shops that are owned by foreign nationals only.
This bit of misinformation busting in the president's speech is crucial. Spaza shops have a history of being at the center of often violent xenophobia in South Africa. This narrative has picked up again. Some anti-migrant groups have picketed to stop foreign nationals from getting licenses. Victoria Africa from the far-right Patriotic Alliance Party says foreign nationals should not own informal businesses.
Our kids are dying on a daily basis. Foreigners are flooding the informal market, and we are expected to keep quiet as a country. We're not going to do that. In fact, we are here today to mark our territory. The township economy will belong to South Africans. We are not.
The anti-migrant group turned political party Operation Dudula is saying they are taking this issue to court soon. Group President Sandile Dabula says they want to shut down all the unregistered businesses.
We've seen how these guys manufacture their own food. And the unfortunate part of it is that even our own South Africans that are trading informally, so they get their stock from the very same people who is manufacturing fake products. So it means this whole chain is not safe.
By fake food, she means counterfeit or adulterated products, like something that has been mislabeled or diluted. Recent raids on warehouses and shops have revealed those. Meanwhile, shop owners themselves are worried about registering with municipalities by the mid-December deadline.
We want to register, but the time is too short to do it. Even the office, they don't understand what they do.
The country is now considering whether to declare the ongoing deaths as a national disaster. If this happens, South Africa's government will be able to spend more money on the problem. In the meantime, tensions are high, and particularly parents are concerned. For The World, I'm Elna Schütz. In Johannesburg, South Africa.
If you travel to Hong Kong this month, prepare to be greeted by pandas upon touchdown, 2,500 of them. Today, the city launched Panda Go Fest HK, a festival dedicated to China's unofficial mascot. The 2,500 bears are not real, unfortunately. They are sculptures made of recycled rubber barrels and resins, among other materials. The bears took over the runway at Hong Kong Airport at the festival's launch ceremony today and will pop up at a handful of other locations in the city over the next few weeks. In a word, pandemonium. It's been on the rise in Hong Kong since August when two panda cubs were born there at a theme park. Two more bears were brought to Hong Kong from mainland China in September, bringing the city's live panda population to six. Fierce protests have overtaken Georgia's capital of Tbilisi every night since last Thursday. That's when the country's prime minister suspended talks pursuing membership in the European Union. Police have made hundreds of arrests since the demonstrations began. The ruling party, Georgian Dream, is trying to fend off the protest movement. Georgi Lomsadze explains what's been developing. He's an independent reporter in Tbilisi.
Protests continue. I mean, they pretty much rage every night. We see police using increasingly brutal force. Special troops are coming out every night and going for the protesters. And we see not just the usual crowd control mechanisms, but we see groups of police chasing after protesters, beating them brutally. And these videos are spreading everywhere. And it is actually driving more protests and more people are coming out. And lots of different businesses and public officials have also made statements against the government's decision. So I would say this protest is spreading and taking different forms.
What is the mood and feeling right now in the streets?
It sort of depends in a way. There is lots of anger sometimes, but a lot of times it also feels like festival because these young people, they are very creative. They come up with creative ideas. They use music to get their message across. But then it gets every night, like late at night, it gets quite violent, mainly because the way police acts. The more people are attacked or beaten by the police, the worse it gets because the protesters also, they respond, they throw firecrackers back at police or whatever they can get. So it's a very precarious situation that can get far worse.
And are those police being deployed by the ruling party, Georgian Dream?
Yes, police is deployed by the ruling party. There is a pattern to it already. So protesters usually gather around 7 p.m. local time or so, and the crowds get bigger and bigger. Around midnight or so, the police leaps to action. They start chasing after protesters. Several journalists have been targeted by the police and were hospitalized, some of the policemen as well. And the environment generally is quite, quite tense.
Clearly a lot of anger, Georgi. Why are people so upset that the ruling party has reversed course on the path to the European Union, or at least put a pause on it?
Well, you have to understand that they are undoing years of scrupulous work, decades, I'd say, that People have been working very, very hard for Georgia to get to this point, to even be considered as a potential member. And just because the government decided, or rather one billionaire who runs the country essentially decided that right now, it's not in his best interest to have a, essentially have a democracy, a European-style democracy, which is a threat to his rule at this point.
Tell us more about that billionaire, the leader that you're referring to there.
Bidzina Ivanishvili, he came to power. He created this party, Georgian Dream, currently the governing party. And the idea was that he was going to take Georgia more toward democracy and freedom and also welfare, because he was so rich. He's the richest Georgian that somehow people also expected. That was also going to trickle down on them. So pretty much after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine began, the government here in Georgia has been taking an increasingly anti-Western turn. It's not just, they were not targeting just the EU, but also the Americans. I think you have to understand that this membership in European Union comes with requirements, and there's requirements that you have free judiciary, that you have a functioning democratic system. And because Georgian Dream and this billionaire have been in charge for so long, obviously their over time their popularity has been sagging. And in a free and democratic system, they're not going to last for long. They're accused of stealing the last parliamentary election that we had on October of 26. So part of the reason that there is a chill toward EU and the West in general is that. But also some accuse him of being in this billionaire of being in a cahoots with Russia. So I would say that the Georgia is moving toward Russia. But how much is that orchestrated from Moscow? It's hard to say.
Gheorghe Lomsadze is an independent reporter in Tbilisi, Georgia. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The landscape of Scotland is dotted with historic structures built from stone that has survived for hundreds, even thousands of years. They're part of Scottish heritage and identity, but the stone walls and buildings are deteriorating because of climate change. Reporter Emma Jacobs went to several of these sites to see how efforts to protect them are going. Emma begins in the archipelago of Orkney in northern Scotland.
Around the year 200 BC, if you had piloted a boat between the islands of Rousey and Ainhallow.
In the Iron Age, you would have seen both sides of this sound highly occupied with smoke coming out of the roofs of literally a dozen or more brochs that are spread out along each coast.
Brochs were round stone towers once surrounded by villages. Retired archaeologist Julie Gibson lives on Rousey. From a steep, windy slope down to the shore, she points out the remains of three brochs.
One of which has been excavated, with its village partly fallen in the sea.
Beyond it, a stone seawall at the edge of the water now protects this broch from future damage. Stones placed on end direct the force of the waves upwards.
Occasionally, when the sea's really bad, these flagstones on the top will get flipped up.
The second broch is just a green mound under a stone-walled sheep pen. The third round tower, without any protection, has begun to crumble into the sea. Gibson tells me she feels sites like these are places where history can be felt or capture the imagination. But here on this island, just about all of the prehistoric houses were built close to the water.
So the upshot of that is when the erosion takes the archaeology from off the coast, which it will eventually, Rousey will have lost its history.
Storm season in Orkney starts in the fall, and with climate change, stronger storms will become more frequent. In the past, storms have actually revealed some of Orkney's most important archaeological sites, but they can also take destructive bites out of the shoreline on top of ongoing gradual erosion.
We are looking at quite significant coastal change.
Mari Davies is climate change policy coordinator for Historic Environment Scotland. This entity cares for one of the Rousey brochs and more than 300 sites across Scotland.
In Scotland, broadly, we're looking at a trend towards warmer, wetter winters and hotter, drier summers, and more intense extreme weather events.
More wet weather, she says, particularly threatens roofless ruins.
We have quite a lot of those in Scotland.
One of those is Elgin Cathedral, which lost its roof in a fire. Located in the north of mainland Scotland, it dates to the 13th century.
I've been looking after the cathedral for 30 years now.
Mike Pendery is Historic Environment Scotland's district architect. He oversees 40 monuments, including what he calls prehistoric lumps and bumps, stone circles and standing stones, and a lot of partially standing castles and forts. He says he sees his work on all of these sites as cyclical.
Working on it, keep it in good nick. Eventually, no matter how much conservation you do, you push the monument uphill and it's a lot better than it was. But as soon as it's up there, it starts the slide of decay again.
Pendery has been experimenting with ways to slow that decline. We climb up construction scaffolding put up along one edge of the cathedral to replace crumbling stones.
What you've got there is what was the old gargoyle chute.
From the top, we can look down on the exposed walls.
So, Exhibit A, one wet wall full of moss and weeds, looking dark and damp.
On the opposite side, Pendery points out where he has applied a coat of liquid latex and sealant with lead edges that direct rainwater off of the fragile, centuries-old wall.
But this has bought it at least 25 years of bone dry with no weeds getting in.
He first saw the waterproof latex at a building conference and gradually introduced it on heritage conservation sites. Pendery is nearing retirement, but hopes he can get this and other techniques he's developed more widely adopted. Elsewhere, Historic Environment Scotland has protected sites with a covering of clay and grasses. Mari Davies says interest has grown in natural solutions, including for problems like coastal erosion.
Things like restoring salt marshes that would have been there in the past, you know, and those kind of things that will then act as a kind of natural defence, but also support wildlife in the area.
But funding is tight for all kinds of projects. Then, too, her agency does not have the direct care of the many more historic sites with private owners. At another threatened site on the main island of Orkney, only a couple of scattered sandbags laid by volunteers stand between the sea and the ragged edge of Newark Beach.
The sea just got in wherever the weakest points were and scattered them all over here. Some have remained, and we're learning.
Isabel Gardner has lived in a cozy house overlooking the beach for the past 40 years. She has watched the water work away at the clay bank at the edge of her land.
And the site's been in use for thousands of years, like any square inch of Orkney.
She and a handful of friends and neighbours look out for bones from ancient burial sites, which emerge out of the banks as they erode. The burials took place over the span of around 1,000 years, and where she can, Gardner covers exposed bone back up.
I clay up, take some of the boulder clay and mash it all up.
But if bones look ready to wash away, she makes a call. The government does fund recovery of human remains. The bones get recorded, photographed, and stored in the Island Museum. But even with these protocols in place, Gardner still thinks it's important to try and slow the disappearance of the site.
It's just its respect for the ancestors. Whoever was buried here, you can bet your bottom dollar, there's a whole lot of relatives. And whether somebody was buried last year or 2,000 years ago, you show the same respect.
At the end of her property, she steps down into a hollow between low stone walls from a medieval chapel.
This will go in the next few months, definitely. That won't survive this winter. Whether this survives or not, I don't know.
Eventually, she knows all the walls will go. But like others caring for Scotland's historic places, she wants to keep this one intact and to learn from it as much and for as long as possible. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs, Orkney, Scotland.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Carolyn Beeler's back with us tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thanks for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.